Well, I'm going to ask you to take your Bible and turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And last week we digressed from our study through Matthew, and we began a series on the family, which includes marriage and parenting, fathers and mothers, husbands and wives, children. And we'll be looking at that for a few weeks. And I entitled it, Rearing Children with Rewards in Mind, Some Suggestions. And the reason I say suggestions is because, unlike when we're expounding the scripture and going verse by verse, this is coming out of 35 plus years of marital counseling and studying marriage, and it is also coming out of 43 years of being married and messing up and learning and growing. And so there's suggestions to help. We're at different stages in our marriage, spiritual development, and so forth. So I pray you take them in that way. We are not experts. So things that I share personally, they're not the last word. We were learning. We look back and realize how much we didn't know, and realize we made some mistakes, and by God's grace, He overcame that, and many of the things we did, we saw that He did bear fruit in those, and I pray the same from you. We looked in Genesis 1 and 2, and we saw that the family and marriage is the most essential, basic, and I don't mean basic, you do it and then you move on to something greater. It is the basic and the infrastructure of society and life and the development of human beings. Many of us did not grow up in families where we got good role models of how to make a marriage work. We didn't see child rearing as it should be. We didn't see people devoted to Jesus Christ and failing and asking for forgiveness. And we didn't see genuine sacrificial love. And so we come into marriage and we want all of those things. That's what our goal is. We just don't realize how bankrupt we are coming into the marriage from those kinds of backgrounds. Some of you had better Christian families and you have a better start. But what I want everybody to know is that, yes, it is easier to build a godly home and send out a godly offspring if you've grown up in that home. But even if you haven't, if you have no role models, everything went wrong. What I want to tell you is by the grace of God, He gives us an opportunity to rewrite our future and the future of our children. We are not bound by our past. It is difficult, more difficult than if you came up in a godly home, but we can launch out a generation where they don't have all of that baggage. So don't be looking back to what you lost. Look at what God's giving you as an opportunity to change and to change your children's lives. So I'm giving you 9 principles or 9 suggestions to think about. And last week, the first one we looked at was married for life and living. Married for life and living. Read verse 4 in chapter 7 of 1 Corinthians. And it says, the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, also the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. And it's speaking about the intimacy, but you can even extrapolate from that. You have become one. And you know what that verse is saying in a little different way? The same thing we found in Genesis 1 and 2. And remember, we said marriage is for life. That speaks to the longevity of the relationship. But equally important is marriage is for living. That speaks to the purpose. And many times people think that the purpose is the longevity, but that's not it at all. And a matter of fact, when you go to a line share of the passages on marriage, it's actually not addressing the longevity, though that's there in Genesis 2, Matthew chapter 19, and so forth. What it's addressing is the living part, the purpose. That's what our verse is about, isn't it? It's saying what you find in Genesis. God said, I want you to be fruitful and multiply. I want you solitude or loneliness to be ended. I want you to enjoy one another's company. It's all about living the purpose of marriage. It just happens to go on for a lifetime. And the same is here. Listen, he's saying, I want you to live marriage, not just be married, not just make it last a long time, but to live it. And so that's the purpose. So I gave you a few things to think about, and I won't go back over them, but you can listen to last week. Spiritual growth of the individual, and that precedes spiritual growth of the couple as a couple. Listening to your mate, what they say, rather than what you think they should say or what you are ready to defend your position. And then I talked about values of two kinds in marriages, and they are very subtle sometimes. One of them is values related to personality, and that one you can miss it just because you're like me, you're adult, but it's not subtle most of the time. We're just not listening. But the other is very subtle, and that is a value that we acquire somewhere in life, maybe indirectly, but it's where the thing we're talking about means more to the person than the thing itself. So we talked about mowing a lawn. You could be griping about that and arguing for 20 years, and one of you is talking about the grass being mowed, the other one's talking about the marriage thriving, see? But you're missing one another. So those things happen. Another thing under this married for life and living is don't quit growing in love. Do not quit growing in love. The love that you brought into the marriage, it's enough to get you down the aisle and get you kind of going. It is not enough to sustain a vibrant, growing marriage. So do not quit growing in love. You have to learn to love. Again, we love, but we have to learn. It has to mature and grow, and particularly in the crucible of a marriage one-on-one with a mate for life. You have to learn to sacrifice. You will learn to sacrifice in marriage in a way that people who remain single, and there is a place for that, and Paul deals with it in this very chapter, by the way, but there's ways that you're going to learn to sacrifice that someone else is not going to learn in marriage. You're going to learn to die to self. And let me tell you, it's painful. And it's never really quick. That's what I've noticed. I mean, there's no shot in the head or anything like that. It's just kind of this knife that kind of goes down and you just bleed a little at a time. So you're going to learn how to die to self. The thing that you valued, you thought was so important, that needs to be done, all of a sudden you're having to deal with, do I really want to fight for this and hurt my marriage? Or am I willing to die to that so that my marriage can grow? Now, I'll tell you a word of encouragement and a word of discouragement that I have observed through the years. The word of encouragement is this. Now, when we get married, everything's going to work great because we have a plan to change our mate. That's right. We're going to change the mate, and once we get them worked out of all these kinks and idiosyncrasies they have, we're going to have a great marriage. That's where we're headed. The problem is your mate has the same idea about you. That's the conflict. Here's what I want to tell you. What I've seen is that some of the things you thought would never change do. And it's a great surprise. I mean, you thought they're never going to change. Maybe they said, I'm never going to change. And you know what? Somewhere down the road, you following God, they changed. And I want to tell you, it's as exciting as it can be. They're different. They're not doing that anymore. And boy, it's a hallelujah ground. And you need to write it down. Because there are some things that don't change, no matter how hard you try. We live in a therapeutic culture so that everything's personality. Well, your personality, God gives you the core personality, and that will never change. But extremities and where it has become sinful, that can change. But the core never changes. So Gene and I both love spontaneity. We both love it. We embrace together as a unit. We are one. And it's always been that way, really. It's not ever been a difficulty. Where the disagreement comes in on that spontaneity is I believe in planned spontaneity. I am 100% for spontaneity. I'm not against it. I just want to plan it out. When are we going to do it? How long is it going to last? What's involved and how intense of spontaneity is it going to be? Gina has this rogue idea that spontaneity is to be spontaneous. Yeah, have you ever heard of such a thing? So there's the rub, you see. We both value spontaneity, we just have a very different idea about how we ought to get to that event and what it ought to look like. One time, and there are times in your marriage that are very memorable because they kind of succinctly encapsulate a lot. So one time we're in a mall and we're just kind of relaxing, walking along, and Gina said, let's go in that select number, whatever it's called, bed store. And I said, well, hen, we're not looking for a bed, and if we were, we don't have the money to buy one of those. Why do we want to go in there? Well, let's just go in and look. Well, yeah, but we're not going to buy a bed, and so why don't we go down here? Let's just go in and look, and we're just enjoying ourselves, right? And so here we go into the bed store. So we go over there, and I pick up a brochure, and I'm reading, and we're at the cheaper beds, still out of our price range, and next thing I know, here comes who? The dreaded salesperson. So she comes up and says, can I help you? And I said, not really, we're just looking around. Yeah, could I? And Gina starts asking her questions, and that's the worst thing you can possibly do. And so next thing I know, another salesperson's there. So now we've got two. Then Gina walks off with the salespeople. So I'm still reading and trying to ignore the whole situation, but I'm looking out of my peripheral, and I'm seeing now there are three salespersons. They're at the most expensive beds, and Gina's laying on the bed, and they're bringing all these different pillows to try, and she's trying them all. And I'm thinking, what is going on? We don't want a bed. And then I hear those horrific, dreadful words. Ronnie, come here, I want to show you something. Well, I'm looking at something over. No, come over here. I want to show you this. So I go over there, and I'm trying to be Christian and smile and polite. And they said, you know, what do you think about this? She said, here, lay down on it. Well, honey, I don't want to lay down, but I can tell it's a really good bed. No, I want you to lay down on it. Honey, I don't want to lay. All of them go, yeah, lay down on it. That's where you really get the effect. Here, try this pillow. And so you know what? It's how awkward it is to be laying on a bed in a store, how much more awkward it is that four people, three of them are strangers standing over you, looking at you, and you're laying on the bed. And they're saying, are you comfortable? Not really. Not really. If you only knew.
Sounds fun.
It was fun, all right, for everybody but one person. Eventually, we were able to extricate ourselves from that situation, and we got on an escalator going down, and I put my hand on my shoulder, and I said, on Gina's shoulder, and I said, hun, why did you want to go in that store when we weren't going to buy a bed and we weren't able to afford a bed, and then you talk to those people as though we were buying a bed? Why did you do that? And she responded, why not? To which I responded, why? And she, without thought, came back and said, why not? And I said, well, hon, that pretty well encapsulates decades of marriage for us. I mean, that pretty much summarizes the experience that we walk through on a daily and annual basis. Well, let me mention the next thing I want to talk about under this is to forget the children. And here's my word on that. Good parents forget their children. Good parents forget their children. You have to stay in love You began in love, but don't take it for granted you're going to stay in love. Life has a way of stripping life out of you and love out of your marriage. Sometimes having a family with children is not conducive to loving the woman or the man that you married. So you have to work at staying in love. You have to spend time without the children. They are not welcome to come with you, and tell them that. I want to go, Mommy. I want to go, Daddy. Well, you may want to go, but you're not. You're staying here. Just be glad you're not locked in a closet. We have to get away. Don't you understand? No, you don't, but you will one day. Never make your children the reason why you can't get away with the person that stole your heart. Don't make them carry that. Well, we would get away, but no, you get away. It takes work, it takes time, it takes dedication. Life is not conducive that way. And you can do things on very little amount of money. We know because we did that for many, many years. But you have to get away. When you leave them and you make them know that they're not welcome, several things will happen. Number one, they will actually learn that when their parents leave, both of them, they come back. You see, if you never leave them, there's an element of security that's not there because they're always wondering, well, what if you did leave? But when it's a habit of you leaving, both of you, and coming back, they learn they're leaving, but I'll tell you one thing, they're coming back. They've seen it over and over. They learn to adapt. Well, I don't know what my kids are so dependent on me. Yeah, that's a problem. Now, I'm not talking about they're 2 months old. I mean, don't just throw them in the street. But don't let them be so dependent that you can't take a break. They've got to adapt. Because one day they're going to leave you, remember. That's the whole point, hopefully. And then remember, their security comes out of the relationship between the two of you. So one parent loves the children and the other parent loves the children, and that's wonderful. But you can't compensate, no matter how much you love your child, for the lack of love between the two of you. Because it's just a real simple principle. Your children's whole world hangs on these two people. And if these two people go apart, it doesn't matter what you try to do, their world just fell apart. It is not normal. I'm not saying God can't heal and God can't protect and all the things by grace. I'm just telling you, you have catapulted them into an abnormality they were never designed to go through. So when they see you loving one another, they get a security out of that because you're together and their whole security hangs on that. So they learn that. You are also teaching them by your behavior what they need to do in their marriage. They're learning. If you never lectured them, what they've learned is Mommy and Daddy always got away because they began together. One day we're going to be gone and they want to still have fun together, know each other, and they love each other. And that's when they get married. That's normal. It may not have been normal for you because you didn't ever see it. But they're going to be launched from your home and know it's normal. And their marriage is going to thrive with that. You see, we begin courting. We begin in love. We're willing to say to somebody before God and all of these witnesses, I'm going to give you my life for the rest of my life. And yet, we begin that way, but somewhere down the line, everything becomes routine and our life is so intertwined with our children that there's no the two of us anymore. There's just all of us. And when some of the all are gone, sometimes the two don't have anything to thrive on. It could be, should be, some of the most exciting years of your marriage. But it doesn't end up that way if you spent 30 years never relating to one another. You have to keep the firewood of the fire of your marriage and romance dry and burning. Don't let the fire go out. Now, some of you, the fire's gone out. The wood is like it's been in the Noahic flood, and you're waiting on Elijah to pray so God will cause wet wood to burn. He may. But try not to let it get wet. Keep the fire going. Don't just keep the wood dry for the day that's coming, but keep the fire going in your marriage. 1 Peter 3:7, husbands, show her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life. Now, what I want you to see, beloved, is this. So we began in Genesis, and we saw this for life, but for living. Procreation, enjoyment, no loneliness, co-regents of what God had given them, a mutuality. We saw the same thing in 1 Corinthians 7. It's about living it. Hey, you get married, you don't own your body anymore. That belongs to your husband. Hey, you get married, you don't own your body anymore. It belongs to your wife. And so does the rest of you. Because you're becoming one, see, in every way. The most obvious expression of that is in intimacy. But that's not the only expression, and may not, and probably is not, the most significant. That is the spiritual progression to this oneness. But now we see the same thing in 1 Peter 3:7. Hey, live with her, by the way, she's a joint heir. You know how you began? Joint co-regents, joint procreation, joint being with one another and ending loneliness. And he said, redemption brings that back to you. That's what you find over and over in these passages. It's about living marriage, not just knowing that it goes on for a long time. Just because things go on for a long time doesn't make it good. And so you are living it. It says to honor her as a fellow heir, a co-regent, a co-salvation person in this thing together. And Ephesians 5:25 says husbands are to love their wives as Christ loves the church. And then in verse 33, it says the wife must see to it that she respects her husband. And so we mentioned this last week, but it's worth touching on again. You come into marriage and you have some perspectives on respect and some perspectives on love, and some of that may be biblical. You may have grown up in a good home and seen that modeled and learned. But some of it's probably not. But some of ours is just warped. And that's what you bring. But even if it's pretty good, what happens is the woman is going to show respect for her husband. And here's the problem with that. She doesn't have a clue how to do that. And here's the double problem. She thinks she does. That's the real problem. She doesn't have a clue, but you know what? She thinks she does. Rarely have I ever sat down and talked to somebody and the man say the woman's not respecting him and the woman saying, that's right, I don't. That's really rare. Normally she says, I do, we do, I show respect. He just doesn't think I am. Yeah, I gave him a glass of water, but you really didn't, because he doesn't think you did, and you really didn't. You respected him in a woman's way, which is kind of Venus to Mars in a man's way, meaning it's meaningless. It has no significance. So you have to listen. What does he say, respect? That's generally true of men, but it's specifically true about your husband because he's unique. There'll be some things you could do or say that show him respect, but you could do it the way you think does it all your life, and he never feels respected. And when men don't feel respected, they shut down. How many times we talk about a woman, well, he just doesn't show me he loves me. I look at the man, I say, do you do that? Of course I do. I love her. I show her all the time. Wasn't I fixing the car the other day, and I work, and I... Whew. He's defining it not the way she's talking. And she keeps saying, yeah, but I'm talking about something. And she goes into it. And he keeps coming back with his answers. So he knows how to love some, but knowing how to love some is not really what it takes to love a woman so that she knows she's loved. That's not the same thing. So he has to listen to her and he has to learn how to love her. Well, I do show you I love you. Well, it doesn't feel like it, not in ways that are meaningful. Okay, tell me what ways are meaningful. And she begins to tell you and you're going, in your head, you don't say it. Here's what you're thinking. That is stupid. That's stupid. That's not real. See, you're looking at it as a man. You have to accept what she's saying and love her in that way. Respect. So we have to listen. We're back to that. That brings me to the second principle. So all of that was under the first principle. Now we're to the second principle. And it is what I call employ the Churchill principle. Employ the Churchill principle in your marriage. In World War II, there had been the successful evacuation of the French and the British troops from Dunkirk. It was a very dark, dark time in World War II. Germany had advanced all the way to France, and everything looked pretty dark. The peril of Great Britain was stark. In that context, Churchill gave his speech, which we know as, "We shall fight you on the beaches." But it was in that context that he knew Britain would fall to Germany. Britain would not survive. Germany would conquer Europe if the Americans did not get involved. So part of his speech was given so that he could curtail any overly positive ideas coming out of the successful evacuation of the troops. But it was also to encourage the Americans to get in the war, for he knew that was the only hope. And he said in those dark moments when he knew that Britain would fall if something didn't happen, his speech does not betray that at all. He says, "We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender." The Churchill principle is we will never surrender our marriage to the enemy. There was a longitudinal study done of marriages, and they asked marriages, and they took the marriages that answered that they were either unhappy or very unhappy, and they tracked them for 5 years. And at the end of 5 years, they asked those same couples, "Are you happy or very happy?" And 85% said they were happy or very happy. You see, sometimes in marriage, you're going to feel like quitting. You're going to feel like walking off. There's not only not a light at the end of the tunnel, there are no batteries, there's no electricity, there are no light bulbs, there's nothing. There's nothing you can get your hand around. There's nothing you see that can pull you out of this except to leave, quit. But we don't surrender our marriage to the enemy. There is an ebb and flow to life, and there is an ebb and flow in marriage. And sometimes it's the greatest thing. And I mean, you just feel on top of the world. And sometimes you feel like the world is a round ball and you're laying on a piece of cement and somebody's rolling it over you. That's the ebb and flow of marriage. But you have to decide, we're going to fight for this thing, and that strength comes through when it is the most difficult at times. I always counsel couples as a foundational thing. I just don't know how you really grow and thrive if you don't take this step. So let me give you an example. So you get married and you're married 5 years. You know in the course of the 5 years that you are going to have said more things that are hurtful, that you failed more your mate and they failed you than you had when you began your marriage. You had some, but not near what you have after 5 years. After 10 years, you're going to have at least twice as many failures, things you've said that were wrong and hurtful, all kinds of things. You're going to have 10 years of them. After 15 years, you're going to have three times as many. How many marriages you think can thrive when you are going back, when you have disagreements? Well, you've always done this. I remember when you did this the first year we were married, and you're still doing it. You're just like your Uncle Pete. He's nutty as a peach orchard board, and so are you. And just on and on and on. And you just keep bringing it all up. So here was a skirmish this week where you disagreed and you had a problem, but you know what happened? You got sidetracked from focusing on this, and you're talking about things that happened 5 and 10 and 15 years ago. And I tell couples, if you don't resolve this, I just want to tell you my experience is there is a point of no return. Now, I don't know exactly when it is, but I can tell you that if you do this, and I would just give you this. Somebody comes 30 years, they've been doing this, and they're still talking about things in their first 5 years of marriage they haven't resolved. I'm not saying it's impossible for God. I'm just saying it's improbable. You have to stay involved, engaged in the marriage. If you've waited 5 years or 10 years, don't wait another moment. Take charge of this thing. Get serious. And what you do is this. When we fight, we bring up your Aunt Martha and my Uncle Hubert, and we bring up failures we've had in the last so many years. Let's drive a stake down so that when we have a fight, when we have an argument, when we hurt one another, when things are not going well, we will not go back beyond that stake. And I just, as a general rule, there's nothing magical about this, but I recommend 9 months, 10 months, 8 months, because you can't make it 2 weeks because there are things going on today that have relevance to things 3 weeks ago, see? But just think if you do it 9 months. So in all of your discussions, one of you brings up, yeah, but last year, off limits. You just have catapulted your marriage to the future. And you've unloaded. Imagine 5 years of marriage, you're still bringing up things. Now you're going to only do it in 9 months. You just got rid of 80% of all the baggage in your marriage. Just like that. And now what that causes you to do is focus on what's going on now. And then you just move that stake along. We did this. We actually had to say, let's drive a stake down. We'd set a date. You agree upon the date, and you don't go back beyond it. And if somebody does, it's off limits because you're trying to take your marriage forward. So we did that, and we did it again, and did it again. We had to consciously, and I don't know that Gina, she may can remember. I don't remember when we have had to consciously move the stake because we wanted it to stay about 9 months, only 9 months. Because you know what happened? It became such a part of our marriage and life that we just moved it automatically so that when these things happen, we didn't go back in years. If you do that, you are going to unload from your marriage so much baggage with one swoop and keep you focused on the moment. The third principle, and by the way, on that last one, I would say there are marriages that are thriving, that are happy, that are in love, they're successful, they have longevity, they've lived it. Go talk to them. They're not going to tell you anything profound. I'm just telling you. There are some basic things. But one of them is don't quit. Third thing is the spiritual formation of your children. And some of this will be in ways you think of, and some of it may not be. The first thing I would say is to follow God. to learn how to follow God. And I mean in the tough and the difficult and the costliest of times, where you feel like bailing. They're going to learn a lot from the great times, but nothing like they do when you follow God through the costly times. Some of them they may not know about because they're very young, and I'll talk about sharing some of these things as they get older and it becomes a part of their adult life. But we went through times when our children were young and health issues and things of that nature and just everything. It was just horrible for years. And we're able to tell our children about that. The one thing we know that we did, we kept following Christ. Though sometimes we weren't seeing his hand, we weren't seeing movements and so forth. And I remember in many years, we just kept wondering, is God going to break through this thing? Is God going to break through this thing? But we're able to share that, and it becomes a part of their life. But other things happened when they were older and they saw them. And so we just tried to be faithful, even though we may be devastated, we may be hurt, we may not can explain everything. We don't even understand it to explain it. And they're seeing our hurt, and they're seeing our loss, and we think they see our great faith of following God. They don't. One of them's told us later, I thought you were so weak. So what we saw as strength of following God and faith, our children saw as weakness. So they may be people who are not encouraging you, but they start acting wrong, they start rebelling maybe, they start saying, well, why do you follow God? Look where you are. Where's God? It seemed like the people over here are doing better without all of that. You think that doesn't get difficult when it goes on for years? You don't give up, because your children are going to learn more about following God by seeing that than all the mountaintops you could possibly be on. And one day, by the grace of God, they're going to look back on that and they're going to see it for what it was, and that was a faith of following Jesus Christ no matter what the cost. Guess what great lesson they got for their marriage and to pass on to their children. Be concerned about your testimony. We should be in the world, but we should be in the home. Your children, they go through phases. I don't have time to go through all of them, but at the beginning they think you're God, and then they trust everything you say, and then later they question about everything you say, and then later they're trying to sort through this where the family faith becomes their own faith. But a lot of that is upon your consistent testimony through all of these years. And then you have family members that are watching you. And I do counseling, have done for years, where people have these struggles because many of their family members are not Christians, and it just makes it very difficult and very messy, and it makes it very hard. And the easiest thing you can do is just to cut them off. And you can come up with some justification. We don't want our kids influenced by that, and you can just go through, and we've been there. And it was so difficult for years. And we didn't see any evidence of any fruit of our testimony. And we would pray, God, use this. And yet we looked at our lives and all of our family. They were excelling financially. We lived in the smallest home. We had more health concerns. Nothing seemed to be going right. And yet we were the ones following Christ. And we weren't seeing progress. And I remember one time Gina prayed, and this was in the early 80s, and we were in Dallas, Texas. And see, I can remember it like it was yesterday. And we were praying, and she said, Dear Lord, just whatever you need to do and whatever it takes, I want to see my family come to Christ. And so we prayed that and meant it, but we had no idea of the hell that would be unleashed in the coming years. But looking back on that, we've seen many of them come to Christ, and you know the story of her mom and dad in their late 70s, both coming to Christ. And looking back, one of the things that they would say about us, besides me taking Gina into a cult, what they would say is, because we walked off, we left our home, left our businesses, and they would say, well, it's a fad. It's a fad. And then they would say, well, you know, it's just a phase of life. I went through that phase, the religious phase, you know. And so God walked us through our own hell. Nothing made sense because it seemed like if he really wanted to show himself, he would have operated, you know, and made us comfortable and healthy and all those things so they could see that. See? That's what made sense to me. But they could look at us and say, you know what? So they're supposed to be following God and loving God, and he's supposed to be faithful, and look at them. But the objection, we'd get over it, would always be there unless we walk through the valley of the shadow of death. And they said, you know what? It's more than a fad. And I'm convinced that through all of that, and we tried to keep our testimony right. We would pray. We wouldn't want to do something. We wouldn't want to give in on this. We wouldn't want to let them have their way. But it always came back to the advancement of the kingdom of Christ and keeping the testimony. And so I know many of you are going to struggle with this. It's very hard. Families are not always supportive of what you're doing. But keep in mind that you are the testimony of the real faith of following Jesus Christ up close and personal that they may never have anywhere else. It is worth it. Be flexible in the discipling of your children under this as well. What do I mean by that? You're going to disciple your children, and you want to do that. We all do. And so you come up with a way to do that. But what I'm saying is, don't be rigid. Be rigid in discipling, but not the way. Here's what I'm talking about. When my children, this is just an example, but you can extrapolate from this. When our children were, you know, 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 and 6, 7 years old, I would read them their bedtime story at night and disciple them in that every night. That works really well when they're 6 or 7 and go into bed at 8:30. When they're a teenager and they stay up till 12:30 or 1, I am brain dead. So it doesn't work, does it? You have to come up with another plan, see? So be flexible. If your schedule, for whatever reason, goes through a nutty period of time and it gets you off, just get back when you can or change it up. But what I see is, yeah, we used to do that, but you know, you can't do the same thing. And sometimes you're going to find your children are interested in longer things, and then sometimes they're interested in shorter things. And so there are all kinds of helps in that. There's different ways to do the scripture in helping them. So be flexible. The next thing under that I would say is live your faith day by day. That just seems like such a simple thing. But you know what? There are very few massively important, significant moments in your life. You know what most of them are? Day to day. Go to work, mow the lawn, change the diaper, take out the trash, say hello. It's just really regular stuff. And we underestimate that. Because, boy, when this comes, I mean, we want to be faithful. Yeah, if God ever opens that door, we want to be faithful. Well, what about where you are this moment? And there really aren't any open doors. There's just this get up at 6, go do this, go do this. But let me tell you something. If you live it every day like that, and you make it your life, and you talk from that, when you're talking to your children, you're talking out of that kind of life in the most mundane things. And they're learning that this is not only for the extraordinary things, it's for the very ordinary. We have our children, they tell us things, and we really were not doing it intentionally. So we were very intentional parents, but some things we were not doing intentionally. It was just a part of our life. And they were picking up on it, and they tell us later, they say, yeah, we sit in the car and you were always listening to this or that, and we didn't really think about that. That's what we did, because that was a part of our life. But they were getting it, see? So you're doing it in the mundane thing. How do you handle when you don't have enough money to pay the bills? How do you handle when somebody gets sick? What happens when the car breaks down and the other one doesn't run very well? What do you do on your taxes? What do you do when you walk out of a grocery store and you realize they gave you $1.87 too much change? Now that $1.87 is not going to break some big corporation. And it's not going to make you rich. But it can impact your child for the rest of their life. I know we're going to be late to the party, but I just realized they gave me too much. Dad, I don't want to be late. Honey, I know you don't, but we got to get this straight. Give me a second. And you go back in. It's these little moments where there isn't anything significant, but it's just your life and following Christ. Make decisions based on growing in God. What this means is that you were telling your children or you were doing something in your marriage 3 years ago, and now you've grown in God, and you realize that's not really the best way to be handling that, so you're going to adapt. See, we're afraid to admit mistakes. It's not necessarily a mistake if you only had so much knowledge and now you have more. What's the mistake is not to follow what you have. When you follow and you say, we did it that way because that's the best we understood God, but now we understand this more clearly, so we're going to do this, and your children are learning, oh, so that's what you do. I love in the round table when I got a freshman in college and I have a 65-year-old man both learning the scripture and seeing a need to learn. That's what our children need to see, is that we're constantly growing and learning and we're excited about following Jesus Christ. Hebrews chapter 11, it's called the Hall of Faith. He honors faith. And here's what I want to say. Even if your children turn away from the faith, don't you do that. I've shared this before, but it was one of the most alarming things. I didn't experience it in the last church because we didn't have many college students. But here, I have seen it many times. So a couple are married, and they didn't do the things we're talking about. And later, their child goes off to college, and the child comes sit down with me and finds out their parents are getting divorced. And the parents' thoughts are, well, we stuck together while they were little and we got them off to college, and so we're splitting up. There may be some nobleness in that they stayed together, but they should have done the right things to stay together. What they don't realize is that that older child, now they grew up, love Christ, follow Christ, don't get divorced, do this, do this. And now they see their parents walk away from that. And what it just had the potential of doing is undermining everything that's been said to them all their life. In that sense, it's more devastating than at any other time. Because they had someone who told them all of this and didn't do it, and now they understand it. Our parents who, they're very involved in the church, they minister to people, they give, they worship, they do all this stuff, and their children grow up in that environment, which is a great environment. But then when their children get older, you know what you find about the parents? They want to get a Winnebago and drive around Branson with the left blinker on all the time. I mean, that's their goal in life. And that child, you know what the child got out of that? Oh, I see. You follow Jesus, you go to church, and you serve other people when your children are little, but when they get older, you go live a nonsensical, non-productive life. I see it. I got it. Your children get older. I don't care if they're serving, I don't care if they've walked away from the faith, whatever they've done, what they're doing and they're having to face day by day is the parents that taught them when they were little are the same parents today. They still follow Christ. They still love people. They still serve. They still sacrifice. And they're still excited about growing in Christ. It can be some of the most valuable parenting time that you have. I know we focus on the first 6 years, so I am not underestimating that or devaluing at all. But I'm not devaluing the next 6 years or the next six or the next six. And when they're in their 30s, I don't know about 40s, I'll tell you later, but when they're in their 30s and you hear them saying what you said and you hear them asking you questions. Sometimes I've told you that Gene and I, they're doing stuff with their kids and we just sit there and laugh. We don't know what to say. We're just laughing. It's just so neat. And we're thinking, they got it. They didn't act like it sometimes, let me just say to you. But they got it. And that's the reward. But then they're asking you, so what did you and mom do, or what did you and dad do when this happened? If you never went through difficult times, I mean that ripped your heart out, took everything you had. When your children go through that time with their children or their marriage, you will not have anything to tell them. You won't have anything to say, here's how you can do this. We've done that. I felt what you feel. When you have that, you have a repository of spiritual advice that has the gravitas of two lives that they love more than anybody else in the world who lived it out. That's what they need. Will you bow your head? Don't surrender your marriage, but fight for it. Take these practical suggestions and realize that they are so priceless. You can have a love and a joy and an excitement like you did when you first met, but you have to nurture it. The courtship should never end. The fun thing should not end. The looking forward to getting away together should not end. Cherish them and build on them. And that dark place you're in that you can't even see how that could ever change, you'd be amazed what God can do and may do. But you cannot slack up in following Him. For you don't even know what He's doing in that very difficult moment. Father, we pray for our homes. We are weak, we are frail. We make so many mistakes. We become so selfish. We see only our own problems and our hurt, and not the ones we're hurting. And not the ones that half their problems are because of us. And not the children, young children, teenage children, adult children, that so desperately need that visual aid model of the parents they love and know walking with you, disproving all the hypocrisy of the world. So we pray, Lord, for our homes, for our love for you. And no matter what we quit, we do not quit following you. And that means all the things you say about marriage, of cherishing and honoring as a joint heir, of loving as Christ loves the church, of respecting and walking as one through this world. We love you in Jesus' worthy name.